The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
I came across a headline in the Times of London the other day which stopped me in my tracks. Quoting an eminent physician, it ran, "I have shortened quite a few patients' lives." Well, on further investigation, I discovered that the doctor had worked in the NHS for some 45 years, witnessing life and death in many forms, and had just published a book entitled Timor Mortis, How We Live with Death. Now, this derives from the phrase Timor Mortis Conturbit Me, translated from the Latin, fear of death disturbs me. Well, the author himself, Emeritus Professor of Public Health, Richard Coker, joins me now. Richard, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Good morning. Pleasure to be back in Ireland, in a sense.
Well, it's great to have you. Reading the interview with you in the Times, which, of course, is based on the substance of your book, you talk about, the first time, perhaps, that you shortened a life. The headline says one thing, the detail says quite another.
The headline's fairly punchy, and I presume that was to get a lot of people to read it. I mean, all doctors see death. They're very familiar with it, and they're introduced to it well before they become doctors, as medical students. And then they're introduced to suffering. And this notion of assisting death really is just a balance between alleviating suffering, which all doctors should do, and trying to avoid death, trying to prolong life. And so the balance is really between these two issues. We all of us die, and very few of us want to suffer intolerably. And at times, to relieve that suffering facilitates or speeds up death. It's a nuanced issue, but it's getting a lot of traction because the suggestion is that that laws perhaps might put people on a slippery slope to euthanasia or whatever.
Now, you talk about the practice of medicine, it is about humanity first and foremost, and that humanity might involve prolonging the life of somebody where they can live that life well or somewhat well. On the other hand, for someone who is in a terrible situation of pain and whose life is going to be definitely limited by their condition, perhaps gently assisting them along that path in a pain-free way might be the better course.
Yes. I think we need to be careful that it's not the doctor's decision, that it's the patient at the centre of this. And so the relationship between the doctor and the patient and their relatives and good communication is critical. All patients should be the author of their own story. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very important that doctors don't step over that and think that they have some sort of God-given right to do things that the patients don't want. The real challenge, or one of the challenges that I've seen is in practice, is that we seem to give a great deal of emphasis to autonomy and the competence and capacity of patients when they're in terminal decline. And yet when they are actually completely infirm and incapable of making decisions, either because they've got something like a terrible respiratory disease, which I described in the book, or something like locked-in syndrome, which is where you can barely communicate because all your neurological processes have basically closed down. In a sense, we remove from those at the very end of suffering, at the far reaches of those who are most suffering, we sometimes remove the capacity for them to make a decision. And that's something that I've been disturbed by and tried to address in the book, that we should be having conversations about death and dying much more openly, not just doctors, but everybody.
Now, you talk about, this high-tech medicalization of the hospital world, I suppose, and the idea that someone can be declared dead on the basis of data rather than on the basis of humanity or the literal experience of those around the sick bed.
Yes. Well, I mean, in fact, some definitions of death rely on technological measurements. I mean, death is complicated, and it isn't just a technical issue. I think what you're alluding to there may be that we're seeing such a change in the last 50 years or so, and certainly over the last century and a half, of increasing longevity, a move to technological excellence, amazing technologies, a shift to dying in hospital, you know, with bleeps and surrounded by people you don't really know. And at the same time, we've got a transformation in the media. So you've got a sort of familiarization at a distance with some people's, particularly some celebrities' deaths, but actually a familiarity with real dying, which is, you know, is lost. I mean, my mother is 97. I was talking to her about how many people she's seen die, and she's seen one, and that was my father. I must have seen hundreds. You know, she's lived a long time. I was a little surprised. I sometimes worry that that the advances of medicine sometimes lead us to think that maybe it can do more than it really can. It can't avoid death.
And I think you quote from Richard Dawkins towards the end of the book, you know, everyone has to die, and we are the lucky ones, or words to that effect.
But right.
You see, the problem this raises all the time is, I mean, we talk about the Elon Musks of the world and the trillionaires. Mm. And when you know you've only got 3 score and 10, probably plus another score these days because of the advances in medicine, 3 score and 10, 4 score and 10, you can't take it with you.
You definitely can't take it with you. And I think some of these people, for example, the guy on the Netflix documentary,
Brian Johnson, know, yeah.
Yes, he's basically, in my view, not living a life. It has no purpose other than a sort of narcissistic extension program. But that's not living. Viktor Frankl, who I mentioned in the book, who was a neurologist as well as a philosopher and a deep thinker and had been in Auschwitz, he talks about different attitudes, and in particular, the attitude to creating and having a purposeful life, whether that's painting or building a business or anything that draws on some creative spirit. But also he talks about two other things. The second is clearly important. It's our relationship with other people. And I don't know what Brian Johnson's relationship is with other people. From what I've seen, it's certainly a little strange. And then Frankl talks about the last one, which is, I think, relevant here, which is our attitude to suffering. So you mentioned something earlier, which was about pain, trying to remove pain when we die. But actually, I think in truth, we want to be aware that we're dying, because we'll only do it once. And a little pain may actually not be a bad thing. I think what we're trying to alleviate is suffering more than pain.
There's another interesting conversation in your book, which I found fascinating. That's the question of medical training and the kind of people who become those life-saving surgeons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a discussion about a young woman whose grandmother has a problem with the veins in her legs, and mm-hmm. the surgeons are recommending, or the vascular people are saying, amputation is the only way. However, there may be a better way for this grandmother.
If you think about this, how long do we spend, I don't know about in Ireland, but in Britain, my understanding is that we don't spend a great deal of time interrogating prospective medical students on what sort of people they are, what their personalities are, what their character traits are.
No, we don't do that. We have a point system, and it depends on, you know, doing well in geography, doing well in mathematics, and you add up all the points, and if you get the right number of points, you get into medical school. So it doesn't. They don't test empathy. They don't test compassion. They don't test suitability. They just test what you might call exam smarts.
Right. And if you look at, I don't know, McKinsey or Bain or some of these very impressive consultancy companies, they spend 2 or 3 days, multiple steps of weeding out people who they think are unsuitable. So we can spend an awful lot of time on figuring out whether people have got the smarts. But what really matters, I think, in medicine is not actually having the great math skills. If you had tested me intellectually on those scores when I entered medical school, I guarantee you I'd be bottom of the class or close to it. But I actually think I was a pretty good doctor because I think I had some other skills that were quite useful. I'm not disparaging or dismissing all the surgeons. I really want to be clear. You know, there are a multitude. I mean, most surgeons I meet are absolutely lovely people and were drawn to medicine for all the right reasons. But every now and then, obviously, you get some bad apples. And there is something about some of the specialties that draws the heroes. And I have a little bit of a problem with hero doctors. They tend to put themselves at the center because they're exceptional people. That's always the best place.
That brings me to the question, you know, the idea that the surgeon who's trying to save a life is trying to solve a problem. And is that the right kind of person? I think if I had a loved one that was undergoing an operation, I would not want the surgeon necessarily to be overwhelmed by the emotional baggage of what's going on in the waiting room, waiting for the surgery to be completed. You might want them rather to focus on the task in hand, the problem solving in hand. And that's, you know, that's the maybe the issue at the heart of this. Do you want the surgeon to be thinking, I'm saving this mother's child's life? Or do you want to say, there's a problem with a vein here, a brain bleed or whatever, and I've got to sort that problem?
Well, you've caught the nub of medicine, which is that it's neither a science nor an art. It's both. You don't want pure scientists and you don't want pure artists. You don't want your doctors bursting into tears at every interaction with every patient, and nor do you want them to be purely engineers fixing problems, complicated problems.
Now, your book has many facets. I mean, you look at executions where the state decides to take the life of somebody, and the medicalization of that, and whether this in some way is a corruption of medicine. I'm not sure what the option is. Should the state ever have the right to take a life? That's an open question, I suppose, an ethical question. But when they do, should they do it as they would to euthanize a dog, or how should they do it?
I feel pretty strongly that the state shouldn't execute people. If there's a chance, just for one obvious reason, that if there's a possibility of a miscarriage of justice, then do you want to take the risk of executing an innocent person? And if you favour that and you just say, well, that's the cost we have to bear, then would you be prepared to bear it as an individual? So I think, you know, I think the Lancet, I think the European Convention on Human Rights. I think a civilized country doesn't execute people. So I actually don't think doctors have a role in this. If you want to execute people, you know, and not involve doctors, then why don't we just guillotine them, or why don't we use the way we kill a cow or whatever? Because it's deemed horrific and brutal. Well, yeah, it is horrific and brutal. So we're sort of trying to sanitize something, make something humane that is fundamentally not humane.
But the idea of the guillotine, you know, I've heard it discussed recently that the guillotine is probably the most humane way. It's literally a fraction of a second and your head is in the basket.
Right. You know, it's difficult to bodge an execution by guillotine, and I don't think there was a single bodged execution throughout the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And pretty much every other mechanism that I've read about has been bodged at some way. But I'm not advocating guillotining, even though it was developed by a doctor.
There's a very interesting chapter on wellness. So you take a right pop at wellness.
I have a particular rant at the wellness industry. I do, because I think it does an enormous amount of harm. I was speaking to a friend of mine that I mentioned in the book, who said actually it doesn't do any harm. It's just, you know, it makes people happy. And I recall the mother of a patient with AIDS who had hours to live. And she prostrated herself on the floor in the ward at St. Mary's Hospital, begging me to give her son some royal jelly. And I thought, you know, I thought, this is so sad. She has been told by an industry that there is some cure to her son, and that conventional medicine was failing her son. So her relationship with me and her son and the nurses was just, you know, was broken. Ever since then, I thought the relationship between doctors and their patients is so important, and it's based on trust. And the wellness industry breaks that trust, and it does it with impunity. It's profit making, and there's almost no evidence that large parts of it do anything to benefit people whatsoever. These are vast industries. This is a vast industry. So I do have a particular problem. And that's not to say that I think, you know, doctors are gods and you should believe what every doctor says, because I do have a pop at the medical profession as well. Mm. You know, the profit motive can be a real driver of innovation, but it can also be pernicious when it creeps into certain areas.
There are so many elements to your book. There's a chapter on desire and eroticism and its proximity to the feelings of dying, I suppose. And you talk about that. You talk about aging and the cost of drugs, the cost of high-tech medicine and what we owe to the aged in terms of keeping them going and so on. But the book is absolutely fascinating. It's entitled Timor Mortis, How We Live with Death. And its author is Emeritus Professor of Public Health, Richard Coker. Richard, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Mr. Kenny, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.